TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Supremely Political Court.
The court has been very protective of executive power. Neither Congress nor the Constitution granted this power to the executive, but the bench declared that in matters of foreign policy and national security, the president now could do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibition.
In his extraordinary 26-minute history of the Supreme Court, Dr. Michael Parenti warned us in 1995 that this partisan aristocratic institution might one day empower an autocratic president. It seems that time has come, and two Trump appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, can push the scales of justice in favor of his politics. Unless there's a groundswell to question and change the legal rules of the Supreme Court, why is so much power being given to 9 unelected judges with no term limits? Here's my introduction to the program when it premiered in 1995. Michael Parenti was born into a working-class Italian family in East Harlem, New York City. He went on to receive his PhD in political science at Yale in 1962. His academic career was cut short by his dismissal. He was arrested for protesting the U.S. war in Vietnam. Parenti became an independent scholar, lecturer, and author. And he remained an activist as well. In 1995, I produced the 12-part TUC radio series, Democracy, What Went Wrong?, using archival and new recordings of Parenti's lectures. He comments on major institutions such as the military, the CIA, media, corporations, universities, police, and the Supreme Court, offering suggestions on how to regain democratic control. Today I chose to rebroadcast Michael Parenti's extraordinary history and analysis of the Supreme Court. Over 20 years ago, Parenti already pointed to the role of the court in concentrating wealth in the top 1%, and the way in which the Supreme Court expanded the power of corporations and laid the groundwork for what later became the Citizens United ruling of 2009. And most dangerously, how the Supreme Court began to give powers to the president in matters of foreign policy and national security that neither Congress nor the Constitution had granted. Parenti said, by judicial fiat, the president could now do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibitions. The example of unchallenged executive power that Parenti quoted 20 years ago in this talk, or the undeclared war in Vietnam, the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Grenada, and the U.S. invasion of Panama. Here's Michael Parenti on the Supremely Political Court.
We're told that our Constitution is a flexible one that grows with time. It's an elastic instrument. If it is, much of the stretching has been done by the 9 persons on the Supreme Court, and the directions in which they pull are largely determined by their own ideological predilections. As Chief Justice Hughes pointed out years ago, we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. That's a direct quote. By its nature, the Supreme Court is something of an aristocratic branch of government. Its members are appointed rather than elected. They enjoy life tenure and are formally accountable to no one once in office, and they have the final word on constitutional matters, and a great influence in their power to interpret the scope and intent of laws. As intended by the framers, the court's mandate is to act as a check on the democratic majority and as a protector of private contract, credit, and property. Generally speaking, in class background and political proclivity, the justices have been more commonly identified throughout the ages with the landed interests rather than with the landless. They've identified with the slave owners rather than the slaves, the industrialists rather than the workers, the exponents of Herbert Spencer rather than of Karl Marx. Over a century ago, Justice Miller, a Lincoln appointee to the court, made note of the judiciary's class biases. Quote, "It is vain to contend with judges who have been at the bar, the advocates, for 40 years of railroad companies and all forms of associated capital. All their training, all their feelings are from the start in favor of those who need no such influence." Unquote. How a Supreme Court justice or any other federal judge decides a case has less to do with objective inquiry than with his or her ideological preference. Both conservative and liberal ideologies, of course, accept the existing economic system as an unchallengeable given. Occasionally, a president will select someone for the court whose behavior goes contrary to his expectations. But generally, presidents have been successful in matching court appointments with their own ideological preferences. President Reagan was second to nobody in this endeavor. He stocked more than half of the 744 federal judgeships with ideologically committed conservatives, mostly in their 30s and 40s, who would be handing down decisions and shaping the law of the land into the second and third decades of the next century. As compared to his predecessor, Jimmy Carter, Reagan appointed very few blacks, Latinos, or women. He also picked many more upper-class persons. 81% of his appointees had incomes of over $200,000. 23% admitted to being millionaires. That's only the ones who admitted it. Reagan's successor, George Bush, appointed an additional 195 federal judges, usually youngish right-wing conservatives, including Clarence Thomas, a 43-year-old undistinguished arch-conservative to replace the great Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas will be delivering opinions on into the third decade of the next century, maybe the fourth or fifth, too. When Bill Clinton, a Democrat, became president, he had the opportunity to appoint more than 100 vacancies and introduce some ideological diversity in the courts. As of today, he's filled about 160 of these vacancies, most without a liberal orientation, most of them kind of nondescript in their politics, if they have any politics at all. His two Supreme Court appointees had voted more often with the conservatives than the liberals on economic issues. It is said that the devil himself can quote the Bible for his own purposes. The Constitution is not unlike the Bible in this respect. Over the generations, the Supreme Court justices have really shown a really infernal agility in finding constitutional justifications for the continuations of almost every inequity and iniquity, be it slavery or segregation, child labor or the 16-hour workday, state sedition laws or assaults on the First Amendment. Under the state sedition laws, for instance, people went to jail for 20, 30 years because they said things that officials didn't like. In its early days under Chief Justice John Marshall, the court emerged as a guardian of property, declaring that a corporation was to be considered a person entitled to all the rights accorded persons under the Constitution. Much of the debate around the Supreme Court today centers on whether, one, the court should act politically and ideologically by exercising a liberal judicial activism, vigorously supporting individual rights and needs, or B, should it employ a conservative judicial restraint by deferring to the other two branches and cleaving close to the traditional intent of the Constitution. In practice, conservative justices are just as ideologically activist as liberal ones, if not more so. Only during a relatively few periods, most notably in the 1960s, did the High Court become an active supporter of individual rights and economic reform on behalf of the poor. Through most of its history, the court has engaged in a conservative judicial activism in defense of wealthy and propertied interests. when the federal government wanted to establish national banks or give away half the country to private speculators or subsidize industries or set up commissions to fix prices and interest rates for manufacturers and banks or send Marines to secure corporate investments in Central America or imprison people who spoke out against war and capitalism or deport immigrant radicals without a trial or use the United States Army to shoot workers, Indians, and to use them to break strikes. When the government wanted to do that, the Supreme Court inventively found constitutional pegs that made such actions acceptable. When the federal or state governments sought to limit workday hours, set minimum wage or occupational safety standards, ensure the safety of consumer products, guarantee the right of collective bargaining, or in other ways offer protections against the powers of business, then the court historically ruled that ours was a limited form of government that could not tamper with property rights and the free market by depriving owner and worker of substantive due process and freedom of contract, concepts that were elevated to supreme status, even though the limitations claimed on their behalf exist nowhere in the Constitution. In fact, those phrases themselves don't. When Congress outlawed child labor, the court's conservative activist majority found it to be an unconstitutional usurpation of the reserve powers of the states under the 10th Amendment. But when the states themselves passed social welfare legislation, the courts found it in violation of the 14th Amendment. Thus, the justices used the 10th Amendment to stop federal reform initiated under the 14th Amendment, and they used the 14th Amendment to stop state reforms initiated under the 10th Amendment. You can't get any more activist than that. The 14th Amendment, adopted in 1868, supposedly to establish full citizenship for blacks and freed slaves, says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Once again, the court decided that person in the 14th Amendment included corporations, and that the 14th Amendment was intended to protect big business conglomerations. They also decided that it wasn't to apply to black people in the case of segregation. They also decided that it didn't apply to women. For some reason, women were not persons. A test case reached the Supreme Court in 1875. The justices unanimously decided that women were citizens, but citizenship did not necessarily confer the right of suffrage when women tried to get the vote under the 14th Amendment. So the court had made up its mind that privileges and immunities of citizens, due process, and equal protection of the laws applied to persons, such persons as business corporations, but not to women and persons of African descent.
You're listening to rebroadcast of a talk on the Supreme Court by the political analyst, lecturer, and author of 23 books, Michael Parenti, from a 12-part series entitled Democracy, What Went Wrong, produced in 1995.
Well into the New Deal era, the Supreme Court was the activist bastion of laissez-faire capitalism. It struck down all sorts of reform legislation. From 1937 onward, under the pressure from the public and the White House, and with the switch of one conservative justice to the side of the liberals, the Supreme Court finally began to accept the constitutionality of popular New Deal legislation. While traditionally the court has opposed restrictions on capitalist economic power, it has supported restrictions on the civil liberties of persons who agitated against that power. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Yet ever since the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, Congress and the state legislatures have passed numerous laws to penalize the expression of politically heretical ideas as subversive or seditious. During the First World War, almost 2,000 prosecutions were carried out, mostly against anti-capitalists who expressed opposition to the war, including the U.S. socialist leader Eugene Victor Debs, who was in jail at the time he was running for President of the United States. The High Court's attitude toward the First Amendment was best expressed by Oliver Wendell Holmes in the famous case of Schenck versus U.S. in 1919. Schenck was charged with attempting to cause insubordination among U.S. military forces, obstructing recruitment. Actually, all he did was distribute a leaflet that urged repeal of the draft and condemned the war as a wrong perpetrated by Wall Street. Well, Holmes reasoned that such speech is protected by the First Amendment in ordinary times. But when a nation is at war, statements like Schenck's creates a clear and present danger of bringing about evils that Congress has a right to prevent, Holmes argued. Holmes was using the same old argument paraded by every ruler who has sought to abrogate a people's freedom. Namely, these are not normal times. There is a grave danger within or just outside our gates. National security necessitates a suspension of democratic rights. But you see, the First Amendment was designed to protect the very heretical views that we might find offensive and dangerous. Safely orthodox ideas rarely need constitutional protection. There are those who argue that revolutionaries and other radicals violate the democratic rules of the game and should be denied their freedom. There are several rejoinders that could be made to this point. First, as a point of historical fact, the threat of revolution in the United States has never been as real or harmful or dangerous to our liberties as the measures taken to supposedly protect us from revolutionary ideas. History repeatedly demonstrates the expansive quality of repression. In the name of national security, revolutionary advocacy is suppressed. Then inciting words, then unpopular doctrines, then irresponsible news reports, then any kind of criticism that those in power find intolerable. Americans were never given their freedoms. They had to organize, agitate, and struggle fiercely for whatever rights they've won. As with our bodily health, so with the health of our body politic. We best preserve our faculties and liberties against decay by vigorously exercising them. Second, the suppression is conducted by political elites who, in protecting us from harmful thoughts, are in effect making up our minds for us by depriving us of the opportunity of hearing and debating ideas with revolutionary advocates. An exchange is forbidden because the advocate has been silenced, and which in effect silences us too. Third, it is not true that anti-capitalists are dedicated to the destruction of freedom. Much of the ferment in United States history, instigated by socialists, anarchists, and communists, actually augmented our democratic rights. The working class agitations of the early 19th century widened the areas of dissent and helped extend the franchise to propertyless working people. The organized demonstrations against repressive local ordinances in the early 20th century by revolutionary-minded industrial workers of the world, known as the Wobblies, the Wobbly free speech fights, that fortified the First Amendment against attacks by the guardians of wealth. It made people able to go into small towns and talk and disseminate dissident ideas. The role that communists played in struggling for social reforms, peace, and civil rights strengthened rather than undermined democratic forces. The anti-war protests against the Vietnam War challenged an immoral, illegal military action and tried to broaden the spectrum of critical opinion and information regarding U.S. foreign policy. It also inadvertently led to the enfranchisement of 18-year-olds. Fourth, on this question of whether we should allow freedom for revolutionaries or we should suppress these radicals, progressive critics would argue that instead of worrying about some future menace, we should realize that freedom is in short supply in the present society. The construction of new socioeconomic alternatives would bring an increase in freedom, including freedom from poverty and hunger, freedom to share in the making of decisions that govern one's work and community, freedom to experiment with new forms of production and ownership. Admittedly, some freedoms enjoyed today would be lost in a revolutionary society, such as the freedom to exploit other people and get rich from their labor, the freedom to squander natural resources and treat the environment as a septic tank, the freedom to monopolize information and exercise unaccountable power. Those kinds of freedoms I could live without. In many countries, social revolutionary movements brought a net increase in the freedom of individuals, revolutionaries argue. They did it by advancing the conditions necessary for health and human life, by providing jobs for the unemployed and education for the illiterate, by using economic resources for social development rather than corporate profit, and by overthrowing reactionary semi-feudal regimes, ending foreign exploitation, and involving large sectors of the populace in the task of economic reconstruction. Revolutions may extend a number of real freedoms without destroying those that never existed for the people in these countries. The argument can be debated, but not if it is suppressed. In any case, the real danger to freedom in the United States is from the undemocratic control exercised by those in government, the media, academia, business, and other institutions that would insulate us from unacceptable viewpoints. No idea is as dangerous as the force that would seek to repress it. Packed with Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Bush appointees, the Supreme Court has taken a decidedly rightward turn on a variety of crucial issues over the last two decades. For instance, in decisions involving disputes between workers and owners, the courts almost always have sided with the owners, weakening labor's ability to organize and bargain collectively. The conservative court ruled that workers do not have the right to strike over safety issues if their contract provides a grievance procedure. This decision denied coal miners the right to walk off the job in the face of serious and immediate safety violations that management refused to remedy. The court decided that employers can, in effect, penalize workers for unionizing by closing down operations and denying them jobs. Companies can now unilaterally terminate a labor contract and drastically cut employees' wages by filing for reorganization under the bankruptcy law. Unions have been denied the right to prevent members from quitting the union and crossing picket lines during a strike or when a strike seemed imminent. And one could go on citing other examples. Despite a federal law limiting water subsidies to farms of 160 acres or less and to farmers who live on or near the land, the court held that large commercial farms, including ones owned by Southern Pacific and Standard Oil, were entitled to subsidies. In seeming violation of the Clean Air Act, the court said industries could expand in regions with the dirtiest air, even if it results in worsening pollution. California's Proposition 13 limited tax increases on property bought before 1975, so that persons with newly purchased homes carry tax burdens almost 400% heavier than longtime owners, including big corporate owners. The Supreme Court decided that the existence of a privileged class of property holders did not violate equal protection under the law. Some other areas where conservative judicial activism has been at work. The court has been very protective of executive power. The executive is the home of the CIA, the Pentagon, and other national security agencies that are instrumental in maintaining the domestic and global status quo. It is the branch most closely integrated with the military-industrial complex. Not surprisingly, the conservative-dominated court has repeatedly affirmed the authority of the executive over the legislature and over individual rights. The court ruled that the State Department could deny a passport to a former CIA employee who had written books exposing illegal CIA covert operations. Neither Congress nor the Constitution granted this power to the executive, but the bench declared that in matters of foreign policy and national security, the absence of an empowering law is not to be taken as a sign of congressional disapproval. In other words, by judicial fiat, the president now could do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibition. It's quite different from saying the president can do what he's allowed to do under the laws and constitution. Now he can do anything he wants, it seems. As part of a continuing pattern of deferring to presidential power in military and foreign affairs, the federal courts refused to hear cases challenging the president on such things as the undeclared war in Vietnam, the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Grenada, the imposition of internationally illegal embargoes on Nicaragua, the U.S. invasion of Panama, and the deportation of Haitians, Guatemalan, and Salvadoran refugees. The courts decided that states could not prohibit corporations from independently spending unlimited amounts of their funds to influence the outcome of public referenda. The attempt by states to put a cap on corporate spending in elections and initiatives and referenda is overruled by the court. And any limitations on other elections, because campaign expenditures are, in the words of the court, a part of speech. And the Constitution guarantees freedom of speech to business firms and very rich individuals. Thus, the poor candidate and the rich candidate can both freely compete. Both have freedom of speech, one in a whisper and the other in a roar. Like the courts of earlier times, the activist court has played federal power against state power and vice versa to defend corporate class interests. Thus, it limited the federal government's ability to protect work conditions of employees, claiming an infringement of states' rights under the 10th Amendment. Then it restricted the ability of states to limit businesses' spending power in referenda, claiming federal prerogatives under the First Amendment. In such cases, one hears little complaint from conservatives about the court's activist usurpation of policymaking powers. A consistent double standard prevails. Judicial activism that strengthens authoritarian statism and big corporate business interests is acceptable. Judicial activism that supports democratic working class rights and socioeconomic equality invites attack. One way to trim judicial adventurism is to end life tenure for federal judges, including the justices who sit on the Supreme Court. It would take a constitutional amendment, but it would be worth it. Today, only 3 states provide life tenure for state judges. The other 47 set terms limits, ranging from 4 to 12 years. Life tenure was supposed to shield the federal judge from outside influences and place the federal courts above partisan politics. Experience shows that judges are as political and ideological as anyone else. Their independence leaves them unchecked by anything but their own sense of propriety. A 7-year or 10-year term limit would still give the jurist significant independence, but would not allow him or her to remain unaccountable for life. Judges who exhibit a hostile view toward constitutional rights could be replaced. No ideological partisan group could pack the courts for decades ahead. There would be more turnover and a greater possibility for more responsiveness to popular needs. And that's the way it should be. The people are not here to serve the courts. The courts should be serving the people.
That was Michael Parenti on the Supremely Political Court. Part of the series, Democracy, What Went Wrong? How the CIA, media, corporations, universities, police, and the Supreme Court are threatening democracy, and what might be done to meet the challenge. The original series was produced by TUC Radio in 1995. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Thank you.